Welcome to the Natural History Cupboard. Come on in.
And welcome back to the Natural History Cupboard podcast, the place where the weird and wonderful parts of the natural world come together. I'm your host, Gareth, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Aaron. Aaron, say hi.
Hello there.
Hello. What have you been up to this week?
So I've been failing to take photos of that red kite again. but then, and I preface this by saying that I failed to get photos of this as well. I went to London.
I mean, I've failed to get photos of an awful lot of things. You know, there's an elephant and Bigfoot both outside. I failed to get photos of them.
This is going to sound very, very similar to that, actually. I went to London and on my way up, I must have seen. So I can't take a photo of one red kite, but on my way up to London, you know, you get onto the M4 and you just start seeing red kites like everywhere.
Oh, it's just red kite central there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In my whole time driving the M4, there was only one buzzard. The rest were all red kites, which is the exact opposite of where we live. Managed to get no photos of these like 6, 7, 8, red kites. That's an estimate of how many there were. And then as we got into London and we went out for the evening, for the night. And on the way home, whatever forsaken time of morning it was, it was like, it's got to be about 3 o'clock. It was 3 o'clock when we
left. Did you go for a night out on the drink, did you?
Well, bearing in mind I don't drink, but yeah.
I was going to say, that's why I find it rather odd.
We went up for a friend's wedding anniversary, 10 years wedding anniversary. And lovely meal, and then on to a Latin dance club. Me and Atta were the only two left standing. We left at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I kid you not, bear in mind how rarely I see them down here.
Foxes everywhere.
It was the first time I've ever seen an urban fox.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Not just one, but eight of them on the way back to the hotel. Incredible. Yeah. And so, like, they're
bold.
They didn't dart away. They just kind of watched us go. And I mean, a couple of them didn't notice us. They were darting just generally. But yeah, the couple that noticed us just kind of watched us. And I just thought, like, what a stunning animal. And to be that close and to see it without, like, you know, like anything like obstructing the view was really lucky.
Did you get any photos of those?
No, like I said, I prefaced this by saying I didn't get a photo of any of these. And then on the way home, just outside of London, saw a fair few roe deer. And then as we got back into Devon, heard a red deer too, like really close to the road. So just seen loads of wildlife this weekend without going out to see them. And just very privileged. I do wish I'd gotten some photos of the fox. The only camera I had on me is my mobile phone, and it's fairly broken. So the camera, the photos are all like white and blurred, so you wouldn't see anything even if I did take photos. But yeah, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a good weekend for all those reasons, really. Though been a bit rough since, to be honest.
Oh dear. Well, yeah, I've not.
Well, bear in mind, I don't drink, so it's illness.
I was going to say, I've not had you down for much of a drinker for quite a while there, and yeah.
No, it's it's illness. Also, even because I'm quite wary of what people, nefarious people, get up to. So when I did have my Pepsi Cola, my hand was firmly covering the top of it. So it's not even. I can't even say it's spiked. It's just. Oh, I don't feel.
There's nothing wrong with that. We've all felt a bit rubbish. I've not done a giant amount, although I did end up going to the Southwest Invertebrate Show Which we, if you cast your mind back to this time last year, myself and Drew were there. We were,
That's right, we were there
representing the podcast. This time,
networking,
we didn't have a table. I went just purely in the guise of the animal care lecturer, just to go and have a wander around and see what I could get. I got to admit, it was rammed.
Yeah.
My God, there was more people than I care to be around. I don't mind. Like, I really like going to the invertebrate fairs and things like that. But yeah, there was too many people this time. I don't know whether it was because the last time I was there, I was sat behind my table, so I felt nice and secure and everything. And I'd been in there earlier, I'd looked around at everything because everyone was setting up. But this time I just was not feeling it. I ended up buying myself a nice plant. Didn't buy any invertebrates for myself or anything like that. To be honest, I've not really felt the need to get any new stuff for a while now.
Hmm.
If anything, I want my cockroaches need paring down. But far too many of them at the moment. So apart from that, I've been building a basking shark head, getting ready for our live performance in April, without giving too much away. But that's been a bit of fun. I was doing a bit of carpentry to get that built. It's almost done.
Oh,
right. Well, whilst you chew on that that biscuit there, Aaron, shall we head into the news then?
Let's do it.
Professional as always.
It's the news!
Right, well, we're into this week's news. Aaron, take us away.
Yeah, sure. Every week we're inundated with news coming out of the weird and wonderful world of natural sciences. And though we are but a small team, we want you, our fellow cupboard dwellers, to be kept up to date on the good, the bad, and the extraordinary. So let's open up our natural history cupboard newsreel, where we compiled some of the more interesting headlines, and dive on in.
Well, starting things off for you, I'm going to take us to the BBC News for the Forest of Dean, which is a forest right here in the UK, where they're talking about the Forest of Dean, people learning to live alongside wild boar. Wild boar were hunted to extinction in the Forest of Dean around 700 years ago before being reintroduced into the forest in the 1990s. People are now happily living alongside wild boar after misunderstandings them for years, according to new research. Naturalist Chantelle Lyons has studied the animals in the Forest of Dean and said people are becoming far more familiar with the feral species. It seems people are more chilled about them because they're more familiar, says Miss Lyons. The boar were once common in the countryside, and in recent years, several populations have started to roam England and Scottish woods once again due to accidental and illegal releases into the wild. That's the only concerning thing in my mind, is the fact that they have been accidentally and illegally introduced into some areas. And unlike things like otters, or was it beavers was the other one that people thought that had been accidentally introduced into some areas, these can do a decent amount of damage to things, and our bluebell woods as well. So I'm on the fence when it comes to boar, because there are certain parts of our ecosystem that are a bit more fragile than other parts in, say, Europe, going similar to what we were talking about last week with pine marten, and the UK being slightly different, because we have bluebell woods that are exquisite compared to most of Europe's because of the lack of wild boar. So either way, we need to be managing things, I'd say. But it's good to see that people are living better alongside a large animal like that.
Well, now they know, and knowing is half the battle.
Oh,
G.I. Joe! that's really good, though. I do agree the boar should be managed appropriately. But no, good. My first article comes to us from fizz.org, and it's Janitors of the Sea, Overharvested sea cucumbers play a crucial role in protecting coral. The marine rainforest we call coral reefs cover just 1% of the Earth's surface, and that small percentage is extremely threatened. Despite this, they are home to 25% of all known marine organisms. In new groundbreaking research, the Environmental Biology Department in the School of Biological Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology has discovered that there is a small missing feature that plays a colossal role in keeping these habitats safe, the sea cucumber. Essentially, vacuum cleaners, the sea cucumber goes about its life devouring sediments, the very sediments that have been known to cause coral disease. But these overlooked and underappreciated animals are low in population density due to being harvested as food by humans, and they don't breed well in low numbers either, so it takes a long time to replenish their populations. The lead researchers hope that this study will see sea cucumbers gain more protections and put limits on their harvesting. The results have certainly highlighted how underrated these animals are, and they will henceforth be a species listed for a future creature feature.
I mean, you've got to feel sorry for them in many, many ways. Apart from the fact that they'll throw out their stomach if something threatens them, there's also many species of fish that live inside of their anus. So, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, there's not much they can do about it. They're just sort of sat there on the seafloor. So, yeah. Anyway, my next article comes to us from the British Divers Marine Life Rescue website. A fantastic group that does an awful lot to help stranded marine life around the UK. And this is Lone Dolphin Stranding in Cornwall. On Friday the 16th of February, the British Divers Marine Life Rescue were alerted to a lone common dolphin circling in the shallows of an inlet near Porthoscow in Cornwall. Basically, several medics were sent down to watch over the animal. They found that it was kind of distressed in a moderate condition with no visible injuries. However, it was not possible to refloat safely in the inlet due to the nature of the geography. Cornwall is it's a place of extremes. You've either got really nice sandy beaches or you've got horribly rocky little inlets that are lethal in the wrong places. Yeah. So luckily, a local resident had his boat moored nearby and was happy to take the dolphin out to deeper water. The dolphin was transferred to the boat and they had a vet on board. It was taken out to the mouth of the Percule River, close to the open sea, the most ideal site for release, where there's a chance of it obviously not re-stranding. When released, it was watched circling in the channel until it was lost from sight, and the area is going to be monitored to basically make sure it doesn't come back and strand. But there are no, thankfully, there are no follow-ups to that, in that it's not, you know, come back instantly and beached itself. So a nice little success story there for you.
Yeah, good effort. Flicking back over to fizz.org, oriental pied hornbills found to have object permanence levels comparable to apes. In some news that I'm not sure is entirely surprising, fizz.org details a study carried out on pied hornbills to test their ability to remember an item or know it exists, even if it is out of sight, an ability known as object permanence. Previously, only two bird taxon were known to possess object permanence, the corvids and the parrots. So this new study places pied hornbills at least in their ranks and even among the likes of the great apes. Interestingly, what clued the researchers onto the idea that this species may possess the ability is the habit of males in the wild presenting treats to females and offspring, despite not being able to see the treats due to obstruction.
That's pretty cool. I just realized that pretty much all of my news articles this week are UK-based with wildlife. And this next one is definitely no exception, from Devon Live, that wonderful source of news. And I say that with the largest air quotes possible. But this is actual news. An otter spotted casually wandering around Exeter Quay. An otter has been sighted right in the middle of Exeter, right on the quay, just having a bit of a stroll around, quite close to people. It's even been photographed sort of walking towards people and just sort of hopping in and out of the water and just generally having a bit of a stroll. It's really good to see otters basically on the increase to such a level that this is now becoming far more of a common sight. just today, actually, when looking at this and actually speaking to one of my students, that they showed me some photos from Biddeford Quay, which is not too far from here on the river Torridge. There were two otter cubs sat right there on Biddeford Quay, which, if for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, which would probably be an awful lot of you, Biddeford Quay has got sort of almost like steps, large steps going up from the river along the length of the river for a good portion of it that you can sort of hop down, you know, as if it's like giant steps. But these two otter cubs were seen there. One of them disappeared back into the water. The other one was taken away because it was looking a bit peaky to be rescued and then obviously rehabilitated and let back out. Yeah. I couldn't actually find the video myself that was taken, but one of my students showed me this video of these otters, well, in and around the quay. So it's amazing to see as well. And I explained to her at the time that, I mean, you know, they're 16, 17 years old, but when you and I were little kids, the idea of seeing an otter out in broad daylight like that would almost be unheard of. And yeah, they've made such a comeback in the last 10, 20 years into areas like this that they're becoming commonplace, which is amazing to see.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. It's good. It's good news. I actually saw the one in Biddeford, the article about the one in Biddeford.
Oh, too. You did? So, oh, right.
Yeah, it was nice to see it. Unfortunate that one had to be rescued, but at least it's in good hands and hopefully.
Well, I believe that's probably to be looked after by the Otter Trust with David Webb, I'd imagine. Which, yeah, like you say, could not be in better hands.
Who we've done an interview with, by the way, guys. So you can,
I know we're doing that. A very referential episode this week. We're yeah. definitely referencing everything.
I think there will be many references in the creature feature.
Mm.
We're going to flick back over to fizz.org for a third and final time from me now. I've used fizz.org for all my articles this week because there's just some really good ones. This one is, a study provides a rare glimpse of the ringtail, an important but poorly understood predator. A collaborative research effort undertaken by Oregon State University scientists, the Hooper Valley Tribe, Penn State, and Cal Poly Humboldt, has revealed an insight into the world of the nocturnal, secretive ringtail of North America. The cute little animal is barely 24 inches and 2 pounds, and yet its weight and cultural significance to the native First Nation peoples cannot be underestimated. The study, published in the journal Northwest Science, found that ringtails prefer tree cavities in mature trees of old forests and young forests where old trees reside, as opposed to oak woodlands and open ranges. In addition, they found that ringtails avoided nesting by streams, but didn't avoid resting near fissures, which are a similar predator with which the ringtail actually competes. The new information is hoped to shed light on how to better conserve this species and motivate further research on similarly secretive and underprotected species elsewhere, because next to nothing was known about ringtails.
Hmm. Yeah. Not to be confused with ring-tailed lemurs.
No, these guys are a carnivore that is closely related to raccoons.
Yeah, they're in the Procyonidae family, which is raccoons, alingos, and honey bear. What's it called? Kinkajou.
Kinkajou. Yes, kinkajou. Yeah. And that wraps it up for this week's Newsreel installment. Remember, if you guys at home have news articles and topics of interest you think we should cover, send them in. You can use any of the usual ways to contact us, and you might see your chosen topic or news article covered here or in the main topic discussion. And with that said, Gareth has this week's main topic discussion. Mm-hmm. So, Gareth, take it away.
Well, you may remember last week I said that I was going to bring a really good, good feel news story to my news for this week.
Indeed I do.
Yeah. After I think I ended it on a bit of a bummer with my last yes. major one. I can't remember exactly what it was now. But so this one comes to us from cron.com, which is a news source I've never heard of, but it came up on a couple of different groups that I'm on Facebook for various different invertebrate things. For those of you who are unaware, I used to be an invertebrate keeper as my main sort of area I looked after as a zookeeper. However, I never had to do exactly this, but Houston Zoo makes world's tiniest neck brace for insect. Well, it says rare insect. The species is the horsehead grasshopper. They're not exactly rare, but yeah, anyway, it's a news article. So the makeshift neck brace was made with a Q-tip and microporous tape, the zoo has said. And they've got this lovely photo of a horsehead grasshopper, which, to give you an idea, if you've never seen one, it looks a bit like a stick insect, but it's a grasshopper. So stretch out a grasshopper to sort of real, 20 centimeter long proportions, and make it long and thin, and give it quite a large head that's sort of at an angle from its body. So the Houston Zoo has made the female Peruvian horsehead grasshopper a tiny neck brace to use because they noticed a crease in its neck. It's really nice to actually see the level of care that they've taken for this. After shedding her exoskeleton into her adult size, this stick insect-like grasshopper species, native to Peru, Ecuador, and the Amazon Basin, had basically molted. However, they noticed that the insect's head had started to flop all the way back due to its weight whenever the insect climbed upwards. So according to the zoo, they needed to, well, to fix this as best they can, because the animal spends most of its time climbing, so its head was flopping out of the way, which is...
Oh, no.
That's pretty bad. That's pretty bad for something like this. It required a problem. So the entomology team, the zoo, and their vet team worked together to construct a miniature makeshift neck brace using a Q-tip and some soft microporous tape to help keep the insect's neck in a neutral position and provide temporary support while its exoskeleton hardened up. It's essentially, I think what happened is part of the exoskeleton had not hardened from basically a bad mold. So the picture that comes with it is quite adorable. They put this tiny little stick running down the thing, the back of the animal's neck. And because of the unique shape of their head, the best way to sort of picture it is imagine a pear, and the very bottom of the pear, the sort of bulbous bit, that's where their mouth is. At the very top, just by like the stalk, just put two tiny little dots. Those are the eyes. So there's enough room for them to have actually taped around the head in between the eyes and where their mouth is and still keep this stick in position. So it's had this lovely little contraption makeshifted for it to basically, you know, help strengthen its neck up. And it did work. That's the important thing. Its neck strengthened, and after about a week or so, it didn't need to have it on anymore. Photographs were all over the zoo's social media, for obvious reasons. And there were lots of quite positive comments saying, I've never seen such a cool little guy with a neck brace before. That's the first time for everything, but that's really cool, another person wrote. Thank you for putting so much love and care into your animals, even the small ones, which are so often overlooked, another person wrote. This stick gets better medical care than me, another one joked. They did say at the end, whether it's a mammal, a bird, a reptile, or even an insect, all of the animals that we care for receive the same extraordinary care from our veterinary team, no matter how big or small it is, the zoo has said in a statement. Together with the help of our entomology team, one of our smallest animals is back to normal thanks to ingenious design of a temporary neck brace. So yeah, it's a really good thing to see. Quite often, and even saying this from inside of the, having been inside of the zoo world, the insects are quite often overlooked compared to the veterinary care of something like, I don't know, a tiger or a chimp or something like that.
Yeah.
But even they deserve as much care as any large animal. Obviously, it's a lot easier in some ways to deal with these large animals because there is an awful lot more veterinary expertise and interest to deal with large, charismatic animals. But there is an increasingly large amount of invertebrate dedicated veterinary specialists who do exactly this. I actually went on a course years ago learning how to repair butterfly wings with temporary fixes for them, I've never actually had to use it in reality. We also learned how to fix snail shells as well.
Well, just briefly explain, how does that work?
Both so
the butterfly and the snail shell.
What you need, essentially, is a box of dead butterflies. Now, that sounds really odd. But what you would do in that situation, if you found a butterfly that had a really badly broken wing, is you find from your selection of dead butterflies a wing that is similar. Now, because butterfly wings are in essence, they're like your nails. They're not alive or dead. You know, they're sort of there, but they're not. Mm. You know, you could cut a butterfly's wing off, and it's not going to bleed to death or something.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you can trim it up. So what we would do, or what we did, was you would take a butterfly wing that was a similar size and shape. Obviously, it doesn't have to be the same color. It's a repair. You're trying to give the animal a quality of life, not make it look pretty. Mm-hmm. And then you essentially glue it onto the old wing, patching over what would be missing to give it that aerodynamic aerodynamic lifting surface that allows it to fly.
And same concept with the snails, just taking a piece of snail shell and...
Well, no, that was essentially just using a little bit of tape and then going over it with, I can't remember what we used now. It was either plaster or something that, you know, hardened relatively well, just to fill in any cracks, for the obvious reason that a snail's shell is its only way of staying alive in a lot of cases, because if its shell gets crushed, it's really hard for it to repair. A snail can repair its shell, though. It just needs that time to stop infections getting in, or or even other snails in the same group eating its shell if they find a bit of weakness, which some of them will. So yeah, these things can be done. It's just having the expertise passed on to the keepers, which was exactly what was happening at that situation. It was a meeting of all invertebrate keepers from around the UK, and the invertebrate veterinary specialist group being in attendance as well. And I mean, that happens every year, that conference. So it's always interesting and always new things that go on for invertebrate keepers. And that was just the invertebrate ones. You know, there's meetings of keepers from all around the world for all different taxonomic groups, which are always...
Yeah, I've been to a few big cat ones.
I would have imagined you've definitely been to one or two big cat meetings, Aaron. Yeah, they're always fun. They're always interesting. But yeah, it's really good to see a nice news story like that. So definitely nice news. How's that?
Yeah, that's not just nice news, but somewhat groundbreaking, I would say. That's incredible.
Right. Well, shall we move on from our news and head into this week's creature feature?
Yeah, let's do it.
It's the creature feature.
Right, well, we're into this week's creature feature. Aaron, what are we looking at?
Well, I'm somewhat excited about this one. It's one I've been looking forward to doing for a while. And it's actually been a bit of a exciting journey researching it. So, dive on into Deinonychus. So, owing its name to ancient Greece, the terrible claw that is Deinonychus would have been a fearsome sight as it sped through the swamp-like floodplains of Montana, Oklahoma, Utah, and Wyoming during the early Cretaceous. At this point in history, these states would appear similar to how the environment of modern Louisiana kind of would look. It would be primarily a location of tropical or subtropical forests with some lagoons and river deltas. So probably quite an attractive little habitat going on there. Now, this habitat is shared with a few other dinosaur species too, and other animals as well. And these include sauropods such as Sauroposeidon, Rugacordia, and Astrodon, which is a really cool name, The nodosaurs are represented by Sauropelta, Tatankacephalus, and Priconodon. Also, Microvenator.
Tatankacephalus?
Hmm.
Hang on. I thought Tatankacephalus is... that's a ceratopsid, not a nodosaur.
I think it's a nodosaur, but you might be right because there was a ceratopsian that was listed. That I...
Yeah, well, the only reason I say that, the only reason I say that is Tatanka is First Nations for buffalo.
That's right, yeah.
Which, if I remember correctly, is what the that particular dinosaur is named after. I know this is, we've already taken you off on a tangent. But
it's definitely a nodosaur.
Ah,
yeah.
Maybe they've called two different things after that, or no, I'm just completely imagining.
I think there's another one. Give me just a sec. Yes, there is another one. There's Tatankacephalus, which is the one I'm talking about, and there's Tatankaceratops.
Ah, there we go.
Just to make it confusing. And I believe we've spoken about Tatankaceratops, not in a creature feature, but we've definitely had
it. We've definitely talked about
it somehow on this podcast. But yeah, but back to the list of species that are kind of notable in this area. I mentioned just then that Microvenator made its home here. There were also ornithopods, Zephyrosaurus and Tenontosaurus. In addition to this, you had Acrocanthosaurus, but they were kind of found only in certain parts of the range. I think Oklahoma, that part of the range. You had several crocodilians and crocodilian forms in an Atoposaurid. You've got Bernice Archer, Goniolophilus, and Paluxysuchus. And you also had a Bolidosaurid, which I was going to struggle to say, I think. Then you've got mammals such as Astraconodon, Gobiconodon, Montanalestes, and Spalacotheridae. Some of these species I'm pretty sure are not going to be familiar to people, but I'm just trying to paint a picture of how diverse the place is. There's also countless species of Lepidosaurs, so that's your Squamata, your today would be your lizards and your snakes. I forget the name of the group, but it's the group that is only represented by Tuatara today, which I shouldn't forget.
That's the Rhynchocephalians.
That's the one. And I shouldn't forget it, as I say, because Gareth did a wonderful creature feature on Tuatara. But you've got the Lepidosaurs here, you've got turtles, you've got plenty of invertebrates, and you've got bony and cartilage fish around too. Like I said, this is a richly diverse spectrum of prey. I mean paleofauna. There's a lot of life in this neck of the woods. Now, in the world we know today, the modern day US states of Montana, Oklahoma, Utah, and Wyoming are home to a pretty important and fascinating pair of rock formations known as the Cloverly Rock Formation and Antlers Formation. The first fossilized remains were recovered in 1931 near the city of Billings, or I'm going to try and pronounce this, Amalapashkua, which is the city of Billings' name in the native tongue of the Crow peoples in Montana, who would have been there first. We won't get political about it, but I thought I'd name both names for it, just to be fair. Now, Gareth, can you name a famous or perhaps infamous historical figure with strong ties to Billings, Montana?
Is it going to be something like Billy the Kid or...
Oh, not bad.
Jesse James? Or am I just confusing that with Pokemon there? Jesse James is a famous outlaw, isn't it?
No, Jesse James is a really famous outlaw, and you're so close to the mark. I can't believe
Bonnie
it.
And Clyde?
Oh, so I'm going to give
Wyatt
it to you
Earp.
So we could go... Now you're getting closer, I think.
Okay.
I'll give you a clue. They lived from 1852 to 1903.
That's not a clue at all to me. Wild Bill Hickok. I'm just naming.
so, like, you couldn't be closer. You couldn't be close enough.
I don't. The thing is, my knowledge of the Wild West and things is very limited.
You've just rattled off Billy the Kid, Jesse James, Wyatt Earp, and Wild Bill Hickok. It's Wild Bill's wife, Calamity Jane.
Ah,
yeah,
right.
I couldn't believe it. You would get every guess was
just getting around it. Yeah,
that was great. Yeah, so that's where she had strong ties to Billings, Montana. I thought that was interesting. The lead paleontologist of the expedition that found these first fossils was none other than Barnum Brown, and he was actually looking for another dinosaur in the area when he stumbled across what he'd described in a report as a small carnivorous dinosaur that he found close to the skeleton of his primary quarry, the Tenontosaurus. In the report, which was a dig report intended for the American Museum of Natural History, he further laments that the animal is encased in a lime, making it difficult to prepare.
So, well, I mean, it's very rarely that the fossils just pop out of the rock and assemble themselves.
It's funny that the struggles haven't changed in almost 100 years.
Definitely.
He then gave the specimen the placeholder name of Daptosaurus agilis and started preparing a description and arranging it for display. Now, whilst Brown never finished this project, he did bring back another smaller theropod with what appeared to be disproportionately huge teeth. Years later, paleontologist John Ostrom would take a crack at examining these remains, only to discover that the teeth were not the same specimen as the skeleton. He declared that the teeth belonged to Deinonychus, whilst a smaller theropod he had named Microvenator. In 1964, so a little bit later, Ostrom would continue his relationship with Deinonychus fossils, leading an expedition from Yale's Peabody Museum of Natural History. And this saw more than 1,000 bones retrieved. Now, these bones were really difficult to associate, and that made it near impossible to determine just how many individuals were represented. But ultimately, there was enough bones with a strong enough association to be definitively from the same Deinonychus individual. These represented the left foot. The remaining bones, however, were logged in 50 separate entities, but they may actually, in fact, represent just as little as 3 specimens. Later, when re-examining their own finds, Ostrom and a colleague, Grant E. Mayer, took a look at Brown's original find from 1931. Their work concluded that the specimen Brown found was the same species as their Deinonychus. Ostrom had the work published in February 1969, naming the creature Deinonychus anteropus, the name by which we know it today. And that means the counterbalanced terrible claw. The specific name, anteropus, refers to what they considered to be a stiffened tail that they deemed was the way this animal aided itself by counterbalancing. So that's where it gets its name from. In July of this same year, Ostrom published an extensive paper on the animal. It would be the first of at least 2 by Ostrom on Deinonychus. Jumping forward 5 years to 1974, and this time another expedition, this time led by Harvard University's Farris Jenkins, saw another better preserved specimen uncovered by Stephen Orszag. The specimen was so well presented in preservation that the fossilized skeleton caused Ostrom to rethink the anatomy of his own specimens. He realized that some bones were placed incorrectly and that some previously missing bones, now evident in the new specimen, actually further changed our understanding of the animal. Ostrom described this new specimen and went back to revise his restoration of Deinonychus because, well, that's what good scientists do. They change their mind when presented with newer, more accurate data. It was at this time that Ostrom began to notice the anatomical similarities Deinonychus had to birds. And here is where the history of Deinonychus fossils gets really interesting, because long after Ostrom's extensive work on the species, many lime blocks still remained unprepared. Gerald Grellet-Tinner and Peter Makovicki re-examined these blocks in the year 2000, so not all that long ago. They found that the individual was around 15 years of age at the time of death, and what was previously thought to be ossified tendons, which in life tendons that were meant to keep the tail stiff, where it gets its name from, They were actually, in fact, abdominal ribs, and that fossilized eggshells were actually abundant around this Deinonychus specimen. Grellet, Tinner, and Makovicki concluded that the collective specimens didn't just suggest a slightly more flexible tail, but that the eggs were those of Deinonychus itself, making them the first dromaeosaurid eggs ever found, and indicating that this individual was brooding, not only showing parental care, but also showing that a body heat transfer was taking place, making Deinonychus as endothermic as the modern-day birds it was being compared to. The discovery of Deinonychus and the subsequent expansive body of work that Ostrom conducted has been described as the single most important discovery of dinosaur paleontology in the mid-20th century. And not only is it hard to argue against this, but it's difficult to imagine a more important discovery to challenge it, save for Archaeopteryx, which was in the 19th century. And in fact, Deinonychus was brought up as the single most important fossil find in history when we asked that question to you guys, yeah, the listeners.
Who did that one?
I can't remember. I wish I'd noted it down, because I've always loved Deinonychus, but I didn't know the full history of its discovery and recovery and that. And going through this research to do this creature feature, it's definitely, I mean, at the time, I remember when you read it out, I said, that's a really good one. But I didn't think it was anywhere near the level of Archaeopteryx. Having gone on a really deep dive for this, I've had to cut bits out for the sake of keeping it within, like, you know, the time limit. But the body of work on Deinonychus and the way it opened the world up to a new concept of what it means to be a dinosaur, I definitely put it up there with Archaeopteryx. And since they happen in two different centuries, I feel quite comfortable saying that one is the best of the previous
one century.
So I wonder what this century will bring.
Well, I mean, I think we've kind of had that with Spinosaurus, I'd say, in some ways.
Well, for now.
Just rewriting. No, think about it. Rewriting what we think of these, you know, giant super predators of, you know, Spinosaurus has changed so much anyway, but the point being that before this point, the idea of an aquatic dinosaur was, you know, not something
that's true.
It was almost one of those things you'd use as a defining trait to say it's not a dinosaur because it doesn't swim. And then, well, I mean, the jury's still out, but I mean, the latest findings saying that it's got like a large tadpole like tail. You don't really have that without having some sort of aquatic part to your day. I don't know. I that would be one that I'd, you know, push in that direction, but I wouldn't say, I suppose, what? Necessarily.
I know when was that? Do you know what? 21st century, we're only in the start of the 24th year of that, but I think you put a good argument up for that one. I'm well, inclined to agree with you until something colossal occurs.
Yeah. I mean, oh, there you go. That might be the other thing is the likes of South America becoming, or, you know, the southern continents being hailed as far more than just these non-existent fossil sites. You know, the idea of dinosaurs. In fact, no, actually, do you know what? I would even hesitate to say that the dinosaur find of the century, this century, would be something like, and it falls into the same group again, Microraptor. And all of the dinosaurs from places like Liaoning in China, where they're so exquisitely preserved that we've even been able to work out the colors of dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's another good. Well, yeah, dinosaur colors. Yes, that's an earth breaking one, isn't it? That's an earth shaker, that one. And you're not wrong on both parts. You've brought up three really good arguments that I hadn't thought of.
The thing
Spinosaurus,
is,
Spinosaurus, you've got, like you say, the southern continents, particularly South America, like with all the fossils coming out of there. But then, yeah, like the sheer wealth of beautifully articulated and preserved dinosaur fossils coming out of
I would
places
I would
like
say
China and Mongolia.
I would say the big thing is Deinonychus was responsible for kickstarting the dinosaur revolution that we now share in today.
Yeah.
And the view of how dinosaurs were and have changed since its discovery has allowed us to get to the points that we're at the moment, to the point where the findings that we are coming across are earth-shattering findings every single time. Well, not every single, you know what I mean.
But a lot of the time, yeah.
It's almost exponentially growing as to the sort of findings that we can do, that we come across, because you've now got the ability to do things on a, you know, like an electron microscope. You've got the ability to carry things out using
the technology,
digital techniques that allow you to model how an animal would move. The ability to 3D print a fossil from scanning it from within a block of stone, allowing you to visualize what it is going to look like before you've even got it out of the rock. You know,
yeah.
All those things that were science fiction are now reality, basically.
Yeah, I think the advances are leaps. I mean, if they had this technology back then, like, just imagine. I think I was just saying, like, comparing it to Archaeopteryx finds, wasn't I? So, I mean, these specimens of Deinonychus represent, as opposed to like the sluggish lizard, they represent this agile creature that's an active predator, not an ambush predator, and a complete, like we said, it was a complete rethink of dinosaur anatomy. This was the animal that brooded its nest of eggs and opened our minds to the thought that at least some dinosaurs may have been warm-blooded, not to mention reviving the theory that birds were in some way connected to dinosaurs. It's such an incredibly important fossil. And like you said, it brought back the dino revolution. So yeah, it's an incredibly important dinosaur to history. But what did it look like? We haven't actually mentioned that. And it's because this question is ridiculously easy to answer. You may not even realize it, but it would be very unlikely that you don't know what Deinonychus looks like. It's just, you might not know that its name belongs to this creature. So I ask our audience this. Picture, if you will, Jurassic Park or Jurassic World, the movies.
Alan.
Think of all the dinosaurs in those films. Now, chances are you're most likely right now thinking of Tyrannosaurus Rex or the Velociraptors, right?
Hopefully you're not thinking of the Indominus Rex or any of that lot.
Yeah, please no. Well, those raptors, those velociraptors, are actually Deinonychus. There are a couple of anatomical differences I need to highlight, but essentially the author of the books and the filmmakers didn't think the name Deinonychus would stick with the target audience, so they went with Velociraptor. And actually, there were conversations between Michael Crichton, Steven Spielberg, and Ostrom that actually went through all this. Basically, the name sounds much cooler and attention-grabbing to most ears. But in fact, it represents a much smaller specimen. Velociraptor is kind of Deinonychus's smaller cousin from Mongolia. And Gareth has, again, bringing up one of Gareth's creature features. It's a really good creature feature on Velociraptor.
I completely forgot I did Velociraptor.
You did. Interestingly enough, we've actually done mirror species, because Mongolia, there's two hugely popular and famous rock formations over there because of their wealth of dinosaur fossils. In one, you get one type of Velociraptor. In the other, you get another type of Velociraptor. But in that one, you also get Linharaptor exquisitus. So you've got two creature features there, one by me and one by Gareth, and both of them go over the species that are basically smaller cousins of Deinonychus. And they all are just such a fantastic family. Unfortunately, the name, they didn't feel the name would have stuck with the audience. So they went with Velociraptor because it sounds a little bit, a little bit more awesome, bro. Anyway, Deinonychus, on the other hand, is pretty much exactly what you see in those films, or exactly what you imagine when reading the books, or indeed it's the image you conjure when you think of the pop culture version, the popular image of Velociraptor. What you are actually seeing in your mind or on your TV is Deinonychus. So it's exactly that. Nearly 3.5 meters long and weighing up to 73 kilograms, but potentially 100 kilograms. This was a big dromaeosaurid, dromaeosaurids being the family of dinosaurs to which the raptors belong. It had 70 teeth, curved and blade-like, set in a powerful jaw that could dole out a bite force of over 700 newtons, which isn't actually as powerful as they initially thought. They thought originally that it was over 1,000 newtons, but no, just over 700 newtons. The eyes provided a fantastic sense of stereoscopic vision, and its feet bore the trademark sickle-shaped claw of the raptors. So thus far, very much the animal found in the movies, right? Well, that anatomical difference that I wanted to highlight is actually in the arms. Very few dinosaurs held their arms the way the dinosaurs of Jurassic Park did, and Deinonychus is no exception. Yeah. Gareth's just done a very funny impression, but you won't see it because it's a podcast.
No, I mean, it doesn't really work in that sense. So no. Just imagine I'm doing bunny hands.
Yeah. So basically, for Deinonychus, I want you to imagine that the arms were held with the palms facing each other so they could grasp a basketball, but not really dribble it. So basically, the Toronto Raptors would be a more fitting name for a netball team than a basketball team.
I don't know. I just picture if you're actually going to do that and you have this pack of raptors that you're letting loose onto a basketball court, A, they're all going to go sliding all over the place, and B, they're probably just going to start attacking people. You know, they're not going to care about the rules of the game.
That's like a barrier up, like in ice hockey.
Ooh. So basically, you're just feeding people to a pack of rats. Okay.
Well, if it's Toronto's raptors, we could feed them Chicago's bulls.
Oh, my God.
That's a Jurassic Park reference. There we go.
Yeah.
Another difference is also widespread throughout the Jurassic franchise, and that's the lack of feathers. Whilst no evidence of feathers has been found on Deinonychus, I should say that.
I thought there's been feathers.
No feathers have been found on Deinonychus, which I was surprised by because I thought that there was feathers on Deinonychus too.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the rest of the family has them, so
exactly.
It would be rather silly to assume that it doesn't.
And it's not just, like in the case of Tyrannosaurus Rex, pretty much the rest of the family has feathers, and we think that the juveniles have feathers, but we're not so sure if Tyrannosaurus... In the case of Deinonychus, it should not be ruled out at all that they had feathers. And perhaps, in fact, inferring that they did have feathers in anticipation of eventually finding the evidence for it is the right path to tread. And this is because that not only do other members of the family have feathers, but it's like, more importantly, it's because some of the more primitive and older relatives have strong evidence of feathers. So we did mention Microraptor just now. Gareth brought Microraptor up for its importance to the fossil record and paleontological history. It's also another creature feature we've done in this family group. Microraptor is an older relation of Deinonychus that is more primitive in terms of dromaeosaurid features. So it's got more primitive dromaeosaurid features. It has feathers. Similarly, Velociraptor, which is actually much younger as a species than Deinonychus is that it's more closely related to Deinonychus than Microraptor as well. It too had evidence for feathers. So when you're talking about members of the family that preceded and were more primitive to this one, and its very close relatives that came later, both of them are having feathers. It's very, very likely that Deinonychus did too. Though until evidence presents itself to prove it, we don't know to what extent that those feathers were present. I'm just saying that it's probably wise to assume or infer that they did have feathers. Now, as previously suggested, Deinonychus was a predatory dinosaur. Its teeth are regularly found alongside Tenontosaurus, an animal upon which it most certainly preyed. And in addition to this, at least two quarries have revealed the two animals fossilized in their entirety in close association to one another. Furthermore, the sheer quantity of Deinonychus in the area, alongside these much larger Tenontosaurs, according to Ostrom and Maxwell at least, is indicative that these animals hunted in packs. Now, this pack behavior is actually contested, it must be said. It's not quite as hotly contested as other areas of dinosaur paleontology, like Tyrannosaurs and Spinosaurs, but it's not set in stone yet either. It's a later study after Ostrom and Maxwell that was carried out by Roach and Brinkman brought to light evidence that suggests Deinonychus fed in much the same way as modern Komodo dragons. Additionally, they refer to missing parts of the anatomy of some of the smaller Deinonychus specimens found in these quarries. Their conclusion is that not only did they feed like Komodos, but they also behaved similar at dinner time too, attacking and cannibalizing their smaller counterparts, leaving incomplete fossils of sub-adult Deinonychus for us to find. But a further study that came out later, carried out by Lee et al., describes evidence that track sites with parallel trackways are quite common, suggesting gregarious pack behavior. In terms of the hunting itself, though, there are two schools of thought at play. Either the pack would lock their sickle claws into their prey using their ratchet-like tendons to maintain the lock, or they would leap onto the prey species using arm feathers and a stiff, but not as stiff as previously thought, tail to stabilize them as the animal wrestled around trying to escape. But the key part is, Gareth, you are alive when they start to eat you.
This is true.
But yeah, that is in a nutshell, your Deinonychus creature feature for this week. It's an animal that, again, is incredibly important to paleontological history. It's one of my favorite dinosaurs, always has been. And it's one that doing this creature feature has left me fortunate enough to learn a lot more than I previously did about them.
Whilst you've been doing that, Aaron, I've in the background been trying to find the names of two bits of artwork that I think of when I think of Deinonychus, for two reasons. Both you and I are old enough that we would have had books where the idea of Deinonychus being introduced was like the new amazing dinosaur, the new, you know, not that either of us are, you know, going back as far as the 60s when it was sort of first described in that. But those drawings take a long time to then sort of filter out of popular media and be replaced with different ones.
So I think that kind of thing takes 7 years from discovery to come to just starting to leak into the public subconscious, into the public domain is about 7 years. And then it takes a long time after that for it to be common enough to appear in our children's books.
Well, the first one I want you to try and picture is actually the original sort of sketch drawing done by Robert Barker, famous paleontologist as well, who worked on Deinonychus from that sort of point onwards. It's that very classic image of it running with its leg, with its hind leg up, like as far as it can possibly lift that hind leg, and its body is almost like a right angle. You know, its tail is stiff out behind it, but its neck is up like that, and its head is very big and almost frog-like in what it looks like. Do you know which one I mean?
Yes, I know which one you mean. I also know many of the ones that came inspired afterwards. Yeah.
I'm showing it to you on the screen there. It then spawned a whole load of ones after that. The other one that is worth thinking about when you think of Deinonychus is a really it's one that sits in the Natural History Museum in London, because it was inspired, or it was done by the artist who did an awful lot of the illustrations that you would see in later books that would turn up, and that is John Sibbick, and he did a lot of illustrations that turned up in paleo art from that point on. And you're talking about Tenontosaurus, one of the animals that they're famously, you know, renowned for always being. You always get the same dinosaurs that are pictured together in any sort of paleo art, you know, Stegosaurus versus Allosaurus, T-Rex versus Triceratops. It's always Deinonychus versus Tenontosaurus. And it's that classic image of a pack of Deinonychus jumping down onto a Tenontosaurus. And it's in the Natural History Museum in London. It's in loads of kids' books that had dinosaurs in or on them. And it was done by John Sibbick, who did an awful lot of artwork that if you Google John Sibbick paleo art, you will almost certainly have seen some of his artwork on a dinosaur book as a kid.
Yeah.
In fact, you could probably still find some of his artwork on books today, I'd imagine, even though some of the drawings are a bit out of date. But those are the two things that images I have of Deinonychus when I was growing up, because it was always the cool new dinosaur, you know, the most amazing one.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And I can still remember as well at the time that I still have this book somewhere, and we talked about like our favorite books, you know, from our kid from our childhood, God, in like ages back now. One of them was a dinosaur book that was a blue one with lots of pictures in it, and it had the raptors as a group, but it also weirdly at the time included Baryonyx, because they didn't know where to put Baryonyx, because the idea of the Spinosaurs was not really a thing at this point. So that's how old that book is. It's always weird to see how the sort of the view of paleontology and the view of these different dinosaurs change. But yeah, Deinonychus is an absolutely amazing species, and nowadays I think looks so much cooler in its lovely feathered regality of it hunting down small to medium sized prey in the Cretaceous.
Absolutely. I two books come to my mind. I can't remember the name of one of them, but it might just be Dinosaurs. The big
book. Most of them are just either called Dinosaur or Dinosaurs.
It might be the Big Book of Dinosaurs, but the other one is definitely called The Day the Dinosaurs Came to Town. And The Day the Dinosaurs Came to Town is like comparing them and speculating what they'd exist like in a kid's book kind of way.
Yeah, yeah.
Speculating what it would be like if they're still around. The Big Book of Dinosaurs, if that's the correct name of it, is more like fact kind of thing, like quick facts. Very, it's a huge book, it's cartoony, and it's just got like a little fact about each one. The facts are well out of date, however, and so is the paleo art. However, they both feature Deinonychus. They both have that frog-like head appearance that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And interestingly, they're both almost the exact same shade of orange, if I remember right.
Yeah, it's always orange. They always did it orange or brown.
And when I Googled pictures of them, the less feathers Deinonychus had in the paleo art, the more orange it was. It was almost like the more feathers they had, the more varied the coloration becomes.
Oh, well. I mean, it's good to see that the paleo art is now sort of keeping up, if not going ahead of what people reckon. So, yeah. Right, well, should we head on into our emails for this week?
Let's do it.
Bing! You've got mail.
Ooh, it's an email.
Right, we are into this week's emails, and we're going to kick things off with our question from last week, which, if you remember, we were talking about this, was send us your best natural history-based memes. Obviously, brilliant for a audio-based podcast, but if you head to our Facebook page and look for that one, you should be able to find it to have a look. So our first one comes from Lindsay Kinsella, the ever eponymous Lindsay Kinsella there, which I'm going to try and describe these as best as I can now, where you have a chemist standing there with a tiny Paracetherium on his hand, and the woman shouting, no, I said paracetamol, which I quite liked when I saw. Although I am going to point out that he's very cheekily put another meme based thing on there below it. The dodo trying to fly away after its first predator in 20 million years arrives, with a seal flapping its flippers. which then very conveniently goes to his his two books, I might add. So sneaky there, Lindsay, but we'll let that one off because they are very good books. Below that, we have got Jen Babbs, and she's put, there are so many, of which she's included a few, so that's always good. It's a picture of a chicken looking rather serious, saying, the blood of dinosaurs flows in my veins. Dinosaurs, I tell you.
It's very got much red eyes.
Very much so. She's then replied to her own meme by putting one with Charles Darwin. The highest possible stage in moral culture is when we recognize that we ought to control our thoughts. Velociraptor, very fitting for today's creature feature, equals distance raptor over time raptor.
I love that one. That one's my kind of one.
A math-based dinosaur meme there. Personally, one of my favorites.
Physics.
Is the origin of life on land is a fish in the water and one crawling out onto the land. The fish in the water shouting, don't walk away from me when I'm talking to you. I kind of feel like that might have happened, you know. You never know. So
it's so good.
Our next one comes from Scott James Puddingcombe. And I like this one. It's a nice, if I feel this is a Drew level meme. This is right up his street. And I think we should definitely mention it to him. It's a picture of a map of North America with the tribes of the Indian nations all sort of listed on it. With below that says, that's a nice nation you got there. Be a shame if someone discovered it, with a picture of
Christopher Columbus.
Christopher Columbus. Why couldn't I think I was about to say Magellan then? Oh my God.
Scott and I park our spaceships in the same shuttle bay, I feel. I like that one.
Very true. Jess, our very own Jess, has put male garter snakes waking up late from hibernation with a clip from Game of Thrones. I can't remember the name of the character, but I think he was one of the wildlings.
He was one of the wildlings.
Big ginger beard, saying, the big women's still here, are they? Which is brilliant for garter snakes. I really liked that one when I saw it. My other half has put, it's a small animation of a wolf, and then it sort of mutates into a pug French bulldog thing, showing how far we've fallen. And it says, less natural history, more man-made, but still history. It's actual proof of how much we like to screw things up. So I think that fits quite well. Of which she's then included below that, the classic, it's a gif, it's not a meme, but I feel it fits, of life finds a way, which definitely
with Ian Malcolm.
Of course. Frank Lode has put below that the one that I believe you were talking about, Aaron.
One of my favorites, yeah.
Yep, is the Ascent of Man, where you see the hominin ancestors, and then the human turning around going, go back, we've messed everything up. So that's always a good one. Karen Kuhn Wright has said, not memes, but I built a snow raptor. And she's included some lovely photos of this very detailed little...
It's really detailed.
Yeah. For quite a small, I'm guessing wherever they are, there's not a huge amount of snow by the looks of it, but they've made this lovely little dinosaur out of snow.
The feet look absolutely great. Everything. It's got a ridge of like ossicones going down it.
I mean, I'd almost be tempted to say, let's, you know, see your best dinosaur snowman, but that's...
I feel that would be a really quiet...
Yeah, it's very limiting. And then the final one from Kelsey Watts has put, he's got a dinosaur, like a T-Rex, coming out of the clouds, very Lion King, with a chicken standing there on a hill, and the T-Rex saying, remember who you are. Remember. Yeah,
that's one of my favorite ones as well.
That's a good one. Well, what I thought we would go with for this week's question, based on the fact that, like I say, we're ramping up production of bits and pieces for our upcoming foray. I was about to say folly then, but that would be very wrong. Foray towards us doing a bit of a live show at the Barnstable Library later this year. And based on the fact that as well that I went to the invertebrate show this week, what natural history events are you going to this year? What's your plans? You know, are you booked in to go and see a conference to see someone speak, like David Attenborough or another famous naturalist? It's completely escaping my head. Aaron, name someone quick.
Now you've put me on the.
Steve Backshaw. There you go.
Steve Backshaw. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you? You know? Are you planning on going anywhere to see someone interesting, or what's the one event that you'd like to go and see this year? You may not even be able to go and see it, but you may want to go and see it. Let us know what your plans are. Aaron, is there anything you want to go and see this year, natural history based?
I missed the Titanosaur that was at the Natural History Museum that left at the end of January. So I didn't quite get there in time to see that. So I am keeping my eyes on other places and what their dinosaur stuff is looking like this year.
Mm.
Other than that, obviously I'm going to be at the one on April 13th that we'll talk about in a bit.
Yeah. Doesn't count if you're in it. You know, I'm talking about stuff you're going to go and see.
I tell you what, it's not, it's very loosely natural history based, very, very loosely natural history based. But I would like to go to the reptile, basically the reptile version of that invert show you went
to. I think that counts, yeah. I've always meant to go along to that. I've just never had the time.
Let's do it then.
Yeah, when is it? Where is it? We'll have to find out. I don't think there's a giant amount on my agenda as to where I'd like to go, but there are one or two conferences on like native species stuff that pop up from time to time down this way. So would certainly be interested to go and see something like that. But do let us know what your plans are, dear listeners. You can do that on our Facebook page where that will be up for the week so everyone can go and join on in. Well, let's sidle into talking about our Patreons, shall we? Aaron, who are our Patreons? What are they doing? How are they?
Yes, well, our Patreons are Chelsea McKee, Connie P., Jen Greenhall and Fogtober. We'd like to thank you guys for your continued support. These guys are listeners like the rest of you who've committed just a little bit financially every month to help us out and make sure that we can keep this thing running to a higher standard.
We're slowly getting there. But money isn't everything, and you can support us in a multitude of other ways. The first and probably the easiest way is to obviously listen. That's always good. If you've got it this far in the episode, thank you very much. It's always nice to know when you get to the end. You can also like, subscribe, and comment on whatever podcasting service you're on. Like Aaron mentioned the other week, we've been bumped up on various different platforms and chart lists, which are pushing us higher up. And that only happens because of you guys. So it's really, really good to see, especially when we look at those numbers and try and make head or tails of them, because sometimes they are very, very confusing. But you can, like I say, like, subscribe on whatever podcasting service you are listening to us on. Write a comment on any of our social media posts. Let us know what you're doing. That's always good. Engagement is good in any and every way that it comes. Apart from that, the other ways you can obviously support us is on our lovely T-Mill shop, where we have some fantastic merchandise going up. So you can find us on our Twitter, our Facebook, and our Instagram pages, where we post daily about what we're up to and what's going on. Other than that, the only other thing worth mentioning is, of course, that we will be appearing at the Barnstable Library on April the 13th. I got that right. Talking about life in the River Tor and some of the conservation efforts that go along that river to keep it going. Feel free to try and get tickets to that and come and see us. But that pretty much brings us to the end of this week's episode, I think, Aaron.
Yes, it does.
So a big thank you, Aaron, for coming along.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you to our listeners for continuing to support us.
It's been really good talking all things Deinonychus, although we didn't cover Deinonychus or Deinonychus. Ooh.
Yeah, we didn't actually cover pronunciation.
Do you want to just quickly throw that in?
I couldn't find a simple, straightforward.
I suppose it's one way or the other to go with, isn't it?
I go with Deinonychus because of It's because it's ancient Greek. In fact, I think the whole word is ancient. Usually there's an element of ancient Greek and an element of Latin.
Yeah, no, that, I think that's involved. Entirely Greek, isn't it? Yeah.
It's Dinos entirely and Greek.
Nikos.
So I'm going with Deinonychus because my understanding of ancient Greek is not very good, but for what it's worth, I'm pretty sure that that would be the way it would be pronounced.
Oh, there you go. Well, tell us how you pronounce it, dear listeners. Although, of course, if you write it, it's obviously going to come out as exactly the same word in both ways. So
that should have been this week's question.
That would have been hilarious.
Do you pronounce it Deinonychus or Deinonychus? Just let people type it.
Yep. Please choose one. Yeah, so a big thank you to you at home for listening, and we'll see you next time here in the Natural History Cupboard. Bye.
Bye. One does not simply avoid feathers when the rest of the family has them.